Monday is for long, slow runs. The ideal running week, not that I claim this happens often, but you have to work from an ideal, involves a long, slow run on Monday, an interval workout at the track Wednesday, and a fast tempo run on Thursday or Friday. Depending on the month and the year, and things like whether one of us has a new baby or a pressing deadline these days, the Monday run is 5, 7, or 9 miles. To show you more glimpses of the city, we'll say that today's run will be all 9, a full figure 8. Twilight technically has 3 phases, each brighter than the last: astronomical, nautical, and civil. The vague and doubtful suggestion of blue now must be somewhere between astronomical and nautical, as we round a succession of curves on the riverbank, beginning with the path by the boathouse, where squads of lean rowers from Notre Dame will appear in a few months when it gets warmer, walking from the building down to the dock holding the sleek boat over their heads. The twilight will unfold, unhurried, across the St. Joseph Valley. There is soon just enough to make out the heron, if we are lucky, stalking cautiously on the opposite bank. To some he's a villain, guilty of helping himself to fresh protein from neighbors' koi ponds, but to me he's an elegant bird. Down past the campus of IU South Bend, and on across the bridge, we are for a few seconds outside the city limits of South Bend, and instead in Mishawaka, our smaller twinned city to the east. But turning right, heading back west with the dawn's early light at our backs, we almost immediately come back onto South Bend territory. Along the way, geese hiss and rearrange themselves, while we proceed on a wide, well-lit sidewalk, perfect for running, except for the minefield of goose shit. Some say that these were once migratory Canada geese, that as a result of habitat shifts or climate change or perhaps sheer laziness, decided to split the difference between Canada and Mexico and just hang out all year on the banks of the St. Joe. Whether that's true or not, they are certainly abundant. With goslings around, they are warier and meaner than usual, flapping their wings at us as we cut through a group of them, dominating the bank and the sidewalk. Mayors in South Bend and Mishawaka have tried to abate the goose situation over the years, but none has solved it yet. Efforts to scare them off have been ineffective. The occasional move to cull them met fierce opposition from animal rights activists, even a vigil to honor slain geese, organized on Facebook in response to a particularly aggressive effort in Mishawaka once. With all respect for those who care for animals, the response to that situation displayed a loss of perspective worthy of TV satire, or beyond it. Even the writers of Parks and Recreation would probably have stopped short of dreaming up the sign someone held up that day, reading "Quack Lives Matter." In any case, leaving the geese alone has proved to be the least bad option so far, and so joggers and geese will have to coexist. Back across the footbridge to the north side of the river, and running back the way we came, light gathers around us and brings the trees along the banks into relief. Across the water from us is the Crooked U, once a VFW hall, and now one of the best restaurants and breweries in town. Where Vietnam veterans once hosted fish fries, the U now offers nitro coffee and ramen with smoked shiitake, glace au poulet, kombu, scallion, and one-hour sous vide egg, with your choice of brisket, pork belly, shrimp, turkey, or andouille. On this side of the river, it's a little more old-fashioned, as you pick up the scent of bacon from the diner in the middle of the farmer's market, whose red walls have stood on this ground for nearly 100 years. As farm-fresh food has come in and out of fashion, the place has hosted its butcher, Polish baker, fruit and veggie offerings, cheese shop, knick-knack dealer, and lunch counter, as always. Now you can also find coffee roasted by a startup in an old factory nearby, and arugula from a community garden network. But the place has never lost its heartland style. Its feel is still homey, and jars of pickled eggs and strawberry preserves outnumber those of salsa and kombucha. Under its roof on a Saturday morning, it is as if American society never fractured after World War II. Korea vets in flannel shirts down from Michigan, accompanied by ruddy grandsons in Under Armour camo jackets, coexist peacefully with Montessori moms navigating strollers between clumps of grandparents, eyeing big baskets of apples and small ones of plums. Trucker hats are worn without irony here. The hipsters are welcome, but not in charge. We pass under the Grand Trunk Western Railroad Bridge and hear the rumble of a train advancing overhead. There is no horn, thank God. I think of the painful summer that once followed a miscommunication involving a letter sent by the Federal Rail Administration. The letter went to a city attorney, who never opened it for the understandable reason that he had passed away 6 years earlier, and the consequence was a suspension of this neighborhood's designation as a quiet zone. Horns from 100 trains a day blared at all hours, and an entire side of town began to lose its mind, and told me so, one email and phone call at a time. My public works staff worked aggressively to make sure all of our railroad crossings met the guidelines to be safe enough that passing trains don't have to sound their horns, then waited, powerlessly, for the FRA to respond, all while my inbox filled with messages, and sometimes recordings, from frazzled neighbors desperate for a good night's sleep. They were not interested in hearing that this was out of our hands and with the federal government, or that the railroad companies were deciding on their own how long they would take to comply with the reinstated quiet zone. I was the one they knew how to reach, and I had better explain what we were doing to fix it. It took months, but at last the horns were silenced. We pass under a bridge, part of a structure that I've begun calling the on-ramp to nowhere. A highway-style cloverleaf here governs an intersection that could easily be handled by a stoplight or a roundabout. It was completed in the 1960s after years of planning, designed to handle the flow of tens of thousands of workers leaving the Studebaker zone at the same time every day, and finished shortly after the plants went quiet forever. Someday it could be redeveloped into a small park, a residential block, or, who knows, maybe a flying garden after the fashion of the High Line in New York, or an on-ramp-to-park project now in the works in Buenos Aires. But that's not in the budget just yet. Off to the right rises the stately facade of Jefferson Intermediate Center, the finest piece of architecture in the South Bend public school system. It seems too big to be a middle school. Chasten taught here as a long-term sub while he was in graduate school, after he moved in with me. The kids here range from middle-class families in the well-off neighborhood nearby to residents of the homeless center downtown. Back through Howard Park, we stay low along the water and come to the East Race, the best symbol of our city's knack for finding new value in what is already ours. The East Race began life as a canal for powering sawmills, typical of the 1840s, when canal building became such a craze that it led to the bankruptcy of the entire state of Indiana and a provision in the state constitution to prohibit the state from going into debt. This canal seemed to have worked out fairly well in its day, but by the 1970s it had fallen out of use and was filled in, a sort of industrial scar across the east side of the downtown. Mayor Roger Parent saw value in it and, controversially, invested heavily in restoring it until it was opened in 1987 as America's first man-made whitewater rapids. Today it's part of our park system, and for a few bucks you can raft or kayak down its 1,000-foot run. We can raise or lower the speed of the water through three large gates at the top, adjusting the difficulty level of the rapids. The East Race embodies our community's style of development. A healthy city can take things that seem like liabilities and turn them into treasure. Looking across to the left as we run, I can see Stevenson Mills, a once-shuttered underwear factory now back to life as trendy lofts overlooking the East Race, one adaptive reuse supporting another. Behind it sits the Commerce Center, once a coal-fired power plant, and now an office space slated for further development. One summer, the owner allowed 11 artists to set up installations in its basement, which includes an abandoned pool that once served as the central amenity of a fitness center there after a prior repurposing in the 1980s. That's not even the most creative use of an old swimming pool in the city. Farther downtown, the former Central High School, where John Wooden once coached basketball, is full of people, even though its bell rang for the last time in 1968. It, too, was reopened as apartments in the 1990s. Around the time I became mayor, a Navy lieutenant named Gus Bennett took up residence in an apartment made out of what used to be the school swimming pool. Though it was potentially the least usable space in the building, Gus and his roommate, Dina Woods, saw a way to give it new life, hosting bands that would play in the deep end and filling the rest of the former pool with sofas where people could take in the concerts while others watched from around the railings above. Good local acts and traveling bands played there, a testament to the fact that a good eye can see future value where others see disuse. In many ways, that's the story of the city itself. To our right is the headquarters of AM General, the company best known for making Humvees used by the military, a continuation of the tradition of military vehicle making in our city that dates back through World War II trucks to Civil War-era Studebaker wagons. It's about 6:45, but we already see one person sitting at a desk in the office, probably servicing a Middle Eastern or European account. In Mishawaka, the day shift has been underway since 5 a.m. On the commercial side of the plant, workers have been assembling Mercedes-Benz R-Class sport utility vehicles for sale to the Asian market. Now that that contract is ended, the facility is being retooled to make electric vehicles for SF Motors, a Silicon Valley-based firm backed by Chinese investors. We come to where the East Race is reunited with the main course of the St. Joseph River. Here, the river is a rebellious churn of swirls and eddies, in a hurry to get somewhere. Trotting up a flight of concrete stairs, we pick up the East Bank Trail, which incorporates a former railway and will take us all the way up to the edge of the Notre Dame campus. The asphalt is smooth and wide, and the daylight is now peeking through between leaves under a canopy of trees that arches over us, as if the city were nowhere near. From my office on the 14th floor, most of the city looks like a forest, and in the summertime you would never guess that whole neighborhoods sit below the dark green carpet of treetops. We cross over US 933, the north-south spine of the city, on a footbridge adapted from its original use as a railroad. I used to hate that bridge. Walking under it every day to get to school, I remember dreading the approach. Cars rushed by with nothing to buffer the sidewalk, which was then barely above street level, and the concrete support of the bridge held up an ugly green iron mass, while an inch-high ridge of pigeon droppings marked the beginning and the end of the passage under. A few years ago, a local artist decided the bridge could be a lot more. With city support, he recruited volunteers, over 900 of them, from local grade school kids to me and my mother, to paint the concrete and the bridge itself in a sort of giant paint-by-numbers project. At the bottom of the hill, we turn left at Stink Corner. It smells fine now, but for years I knew it as Stink Corner because of the sewer outfall there. Fixing the sewer so that it doesn't overflow into the river as often is the goal of a 20-year, near-billion-dollar project I've inherited, known as the Long-Term Control Plan. Judging by the fresh air at this corner, the project has been helpful. Our house comes into view, hard to miss with the white, blue, and yellow of the South Bend flag hanging over the reconstructed porch. The Michigan Street Bridge that I crossed alone in my Jeep an hour earlier is now full of rush hour traffic. Crossing the street and back up the hill toward the East Bank Trail again, we're mostly silent on mile 8, falling into the runner's trance. I become aware of feeling a little cold and a little hungry. The trail leads us downhill, back toward downtown. We return to the East Race, on the other side now, and come to Sites Park. As we cross back over the Jefferson Bridge, I glance at the contagion of potholes and make a mental note to check whether it's still on the list for repaving this year. Across MLK, we look to the right through the windows of the Chicory Cafe, where lawyers are fetching coffee and a couple graduate students are settling in for a long morning. A couple years ago, the owner knocked out a wall and doubled the size of the cafe, partly because of revenue from selling beer after we used a state law to allow any business within 1,000 feet of the river to get a deeply discounted three-way liquor license, helping the number of restaurants downtown double. One beer at a time, downtown has come back to life. We kick it up for the last couple blocks, a sprint to mark the end of the run. Everything hurts, and I lose my breath for a beat, but now the hardest part of the day is over, at least physically. I suddenly realize how cold it is, covered in sweat on the street corner. Joe peels off to go home, while Tim and I walk up the stairs of the parking garage to get to the gym. I shower and shave in the locker room, and make small talk with the others, mostly downtown professionals and retirees my parents' age. One of them asks how much longer it will take to get those potholes on Jefferson taken care of. And as I stand there with a razor in my hand and a towel around my waist, I share my official views on the progress of the road funding bill in Indianapolis, while fighting the urge to insist on a rule that I believe should be understood implicitly. Anyone not wearing pants should not have to talk about work. Soon I'm in my mayor's uniform, dress slacks and a tie, or a suit if I'm doing something formal later. No breakfast meeting today, so I can head to the South Bend Chocolate Cafe and take my customary booth in the back. I shovel in scrambled eggs and ham, fruit on the side, wash down with coffee while I check the Tribune for surprises, examine the emails on my phone, and thumb through Twitter. Fed, hydrated, and caffeinated, I'm ready to get to work. On the way out, I pass by the Triceratops skull in the back room. The eccentric owner of the chocolate cafe is also a dinosaur enthusiast, with a sort of ad hoc museum on the premises of the shop, and head back out into the cold air and toward the County City Building. The County City Building is not a beautiful structure. It is 14 stories of steel and glass, with mostly tile floor and drab walls that proclaim its 1960s origins. Yet it has its certain appeal. I pass the concrete pylons toward the glass doors, walk up to the metal detector, empty my pockets, and lay my briefcase on the belt of the X-ray machine. Under Indiana law, the only reason you can be prevented from bringing a gun into the building, or even into my office, is because the building is connected by tunnel to a courthouse complex. Curtis is working security today. In his brown county police uniform, sitting in his usual spot beside the X-ray and glancing at the monitor, he reaches out for our customary handshake. "What do you know, Curtis?" "Not much," he replies. False modesty. He's retired from the city police and seems to know half the city. His annual August birthday party brings hundreds of people to the yard of his ranch house on the west side's curving Lombardy Street, a stone's throw from Washington High School. Every year he stays up the night before, slow-cooking his celebrated ribs. Once, during one of these morning hellos, he signaled that he was going to share the secret to his ribs with me. For days, maybe weeks, he strung me along. It turned into a game. "I'm going to tell you the secret, but not yet." "What was it?" I'd ask. "Molasses? Beer? Some kind of pepper in the dry rub?" I enjoyed the game, but was also genuinely curious because his ribs were just right, tender, sweet, and juicy. "I'll tell you one day." I assumed the game would go on forever, but the day really did come. "You want to know what the secret to my ribs is?" Smiling, mostly with his eyes, he disclosed the secret ingredient. Patience. At this hour, the elevator will be crowded, and usually I'll know where someone is headed the moment they step in. Homeowner with a tax bill in hand, treasurer's office on 2. Slightly angrier-looking homeowner with a letter in hand, assessor's office on 3. Sweatpants plus neck tattoos plus nervousness equals a trip to the 4th floor for adult probation. A gentler anxiety, mixed with resignation, in the expression of a low-income male in his 20s, usually signals a visit to child support on the 6th floor. A mom with a toddler is probably headed for immunizations at the county health department on 9, or if she looks like she's in the middle of a divorce, vital records on 8. Sheriff's deputy with a red folder, probably a subpoena, is headed to the prosecutor's office on 10. Those are the county floors. The top 3 floors are ours, the city's. Legal, admin and finance, public works. Code enforcement on 13 has a soda fridge worth visiting from time to time. It's also notable because it used to be impossible to see across the room, because of the stacked files, before we maneuvered the department and its masses of paperwork into the digital age. I step out from the elevator on 14 and look to the right, where my name appears in black letters on the glass door to the office of the mayor. In this corner of the floor are 6 full-time staff and as many interns as we have room for, guiding an administration of up to 1,300 employees, serving a community of 100,000. A narrow corridor leads me to the desk of Yesenia, my scheduler, and the first one in today. After greeting her, I step into my own office, walk across the carpet, and take a seat behind the big desk angled to look out through the windows onto the west and north sides of the city. At eye level, out the window, a peregrine falcon swoops into view, angles toward my corner of the building, spreads its wings, and slows to alight on the roof, like a fighter landing on an aircraft carrier. Part of a mating pair living in a box right above my office, she patrols the downtown constantly, sometimes pausing to survey the realm from a nearby radio tower or a building across the street. A dive-bombing falcon is the fastest-moving animal on Earth, capable of moving at 200 miles per hour. Occasionally she gets a pigeon, making it difficult for me to concentrate as I look past an unsuspecting visitor over their shoulder at the shower of pigeon feathers drifting past the window. In Egypt, falcons were considered to be symbols of the rising sun. Now, at last, the sun is up, shining on the American flag flying over the tower building across the way. I take a breath, pick up the phone, and begin to learn what kind of day this will be. Chapter 8. The Celebrant and the Mourner. Civic ceremony, to put it mildly, was not my forte at first. Shaped by my consulting background, I arrived in office wanting to get concrete, measurable things done. My intentions focused on erasing inefficiencies and producing results. I took office eager to redesign the organization of local government and guide the course of our local economy, to see collapsing houses removed and urban infill built. The more concrete and countable my work product, the better. As for what you might call the symbolic functions of a mayor, sitting on a dais at a charity lunch, or standing smiling next to a congressman or governor amid an endless sequence of speeches prior to a ribbon cutting, to me this was a cost of doing business, an irritation to be dealt with as quickly as possible so I could get back to work. A college classmate, elected to local office in another state, once surprised me with the comment, "Sometimes I wish we still had a royal family in America." I asked what he was talking about, and he explained, "It would be nice if a royal family were available to handle things like cutting ribbons and waving to people in parades, so that elected policymakers like us could focus on the real work of legislation and administration." I thought of him often while standing alongside other officials at some event where I had no substantive role but to be present, and imagined what it would be like to just outsource that part of the job to some municipal prince or princess, or perhaps a lord mayor in the English tradition, so I could stay at the office and work on a way to improve trash pickup or eliminate some duplicative paperwork from our tax abatement applications. It seemed like standing there blinking in my suit, which required no real skill or intention, was a waste of time. Plus, the mental picture of a local official, consumed with photo ops, evoked the image of mayoring that I liked least, that cartoon concept of the sash-wearing, cigar-chomping petty official with a puffed-out chest and a shit-eating grin, like Mayor Quimby from The Simpsons. By the time I stood at an outdoor podium one warm May evening in 2015 and raised a glass to the city of South Bend in honor of her 150th birthday, I had gone through a full transformation in my regard for ceremony. By then, my old attitude seemed narrow. Growing into the job of mayor entailed grasping that the symbolic role given to me was no less substantive than the power of policy, if deployed wisely. It was a gradual conversion that began, like most important growth, in a moment of pain, the aftermath of a murder. My first year in office, 2012, was our city's deadliest year of gun violence in a decade. By the end of 2012, there would be 18 homicides, double the previous year. In 2013, I would assemble community leaders, engage experts, and initiate a new evidence-based strategy for dealing with the gang-related violence that had been driving this spike in crime. But in my first weeks and months of office, we didn't have a clear sense of how to deal with the increase, and each violent incident made me feel powerless. Every time my phone vibrated with a new alert, I asked myself how we had failed to prevent the latest shooting. Amid all the bad news of early 2012, one murder got my attention even more than the others. It was the first double homicide we'd seen in years, and both of the victims were only 19. Then, a few months later, an 18-year-old was killed in an unrelated incident at the same address. I wondered what could possibly be going on at this residential corner to make it so violent. So, on the quiet Saturday morning after that crime, I drove to the location, a few blocks from my boyhood home on College Street. Stepping out of my Taurus and standing alone on the lawn of the house, I tried to imbibe the energy of the place, seeking some kind of insight or understanding by virtue of being there. But the scene seemed totally ordinary. There was no sinister aura hanging in the air, just a regular house with white vinyl siding on a small corner lot. A tired-looking man wearing a football sweatshirt walked toward me on the sidewalk, then stopped next to me. I think he recognized me. I explained what I was doing there, not that it was really explainable, and he said that he was a relative of the victim. Then a couple more people appeared on the sidewalk, and a few more stepped out of two cars. Family, friends, and neighbors were converging, and soon it was clear that I had inadvertently crashed a kind of impromptu wake. I joined the neighbors in the head-shaking, muttered condolences, and tried to think of something meaningful to say. Then one of the men pointed toward a car pulling up on the cross street. "It was the mother of the victim," he said, and he asked if I wanted to go speak to her. Honestly, I didn't. It's not that I didn't wish to comfort her or be helpful. It was just that I didn't know how. I had expected to be here alone, and being among these mourners already felt like intruding. Besides, I had no relevant skills for this situation. Nothing from my McKinsey training or college education was going to be useful here. I had no knowledge of grief counseling, no qualification for dealing with victims of this kind of trauma. The grieving mother stepped out of the car, composed but devastated, leaning on a relative for support as she walked up the slight slope of the small lawn, not because she wasn't physically able, but in case she became overwhelmed with sorrow and unable to stand. And I realized then that, of course, I was going to have to go talk to her. I approached her, and she recognized me. I shook her hand, which seemed like an absurd thing to do. I tried to think of something comforting to say, something about how the whole community was holding her in our hearts. "I know you," she said. Then out of nowhere, "Didn't you go to St. Joe?"
"Yes, I did."
"I went to St. Joe too, so we have something in common." Small talk felt unnatural in the midst of grief. But isn't that what we need sometimes when grieving? Just someone to talk to, about nothing in particular, nothing profound, just being there. I don't remember the particulars of the conversation. I'm sure it was awkward and consisted mostly of generalities and obvious expressions of sympathy, a pitter-patter that I would have thought of as inappropriate for the situation before I became more practiced in consolation and mourning. Yet later, occasionally, I would run into her or another relative who would let me know how much that conversation had meant. It was humbling, since I had not said anything memorable or used any particular skill. But this was the point. You don't necessarily console through the wisdom of your words, especially as a public official. It was a powerful, if grim, early lesson in the fact that, as an elected official, I had become a symbol. What mattered to her was that I showed up. In contrast to my student or consulting days, the value was not in the cleverness of what I had to say, but simply the fact of my being there. Not that I, Pete, was there, but the mayor was there, a walking symbol of the city, and therefore a signifier of the fact that the city cared about her loss. Caring, of course, is not enough. As the count of shootings rose, I became more practiced and capable at consoling bereaved mothers, and utterly sick of doing so. Every time, there were the usual cathartic statements about how we as a community won't tolerate this kind of violence, never again, and so forth. But what would it actually take? Attending the funeral of a teenager, whose mother worked as a secretary for the city, I asked myself what would have to happen for us to change the trajectory of violent crime in the community. The police were policing, preachers were preaching, the politicians were condemning, and yet here I was at a funeral for a 15-year-old boy, and I knew he likely wouldn't be the last teenager we would lose that year. Somewhere in the course of my search for answers, I learned of the Boston Miracle. In the late 1990s, during a similar crisis, community leaders tried a new approach to dealing with the gang-related violence that was causing an epidemic of youth homicide. Using rigorous analysis to map group associations, a team of researchers joined with prosecutors, law enforcement, social service providers, and faith leaders to identify and contact the people most likely to kill or be victimized. The young men, nearly always men, were gathered in person for a call-in. Here, officials and community members would promise to concentrate all law enforcement attention on anyone involved in the next group or gang to be involved in a killing, and also offer social services for those prepared to make a change before it came to that. Sometimes misunderstood from the right as an amnesty, or from the left as a crackdown, the strategy's true core is in recognizing that would-be shooters are also people. Leaving aside the handful of people who are actually pathological, most of them just make decisions based on incentives and influences around them. The overall message was, "We'll help you if you let us, and we'll stop you if you make us." And it was backed by agencies committed to keeping their promises on both enforcement and support. Reading David Kennedy's book, Don't Shoot, which explains the approach in detail, I learned of the dramatic drop in violent crime in some cities that successfully executed the strategy. Under various names, including Operation Ceasefire and Group Violence Intervention, versions of this approach were being used more and more widely around America, and I decided to apply it in South Bend. Controversially, I hired an outsider from Massachusetts to fill a vacancy in the position of police chief, and with him convened an anti-violence commission consisting of relevant players from around South Bend. Mixing the symbolic and the substantive, we sat around a big square table at the West Side's Martin Luther King Center, on public display, acknowledging the problem and committing to the strategy. Over a period of months, one working group session after another honed the plan. The call-in was arranged, set for precisely 1 hour, the speakers carefully chosen and rehearsed. A mother, a pastor, a prosecutor, an ex-offender, and so on. I couldn't be there for the evening of the first call-in, on military duty half a world away. All I could do was watch the numbers as a violent spring of 2014 gave way to a period of relative peace after the event. It worked. At least it seems to have worked. Like economic development, our understanding of violence prevention remains primitive, partly because so many overlapping causes are at play. It almost resembles the state of medicine in the 19th century, finally advanced enough to do more good than harm, but only barely and not always. Still, I believe that it has made a difference. Shootings began to rise again in 2016 and 2017, but data from the program suggested it might have been higher otherwise. And the whole thing would have been worth it just to get the relationships built among the working group that still meets quarterly to oversee the strategy's implementation. At countless tense moments for the community, we've been well served by having that team, a federal prosecutor, a minority pastor, a young analyst, an ex-offender specializing in street outreach, and a dozen others, accustomed to working together, with each other's cell phone numbers when we need them. We had hit on a policy that I believed in, but finding an approach as a policymaker did not relieve me of my duties as a symbol. What I saw, beginning on that sad summer morning, is that policy and symbolism cannot be decoupled. As a manager, a mayor must focus on what can be measured and proven, difficult decisions, and the use of new and old tools to solve important problems. But as a leader, sometimes the most important thing is simply to show up, or to gather the right people together to send a certain kind of message. And while the mayor is the chief executive for the city as an administration, it is no less important to be, as the legendary Indianapolis mayor Bill Hudnut once said, the celebrator and sometimes the mourner to the city as community. Perhaps the depth of sorrow we sometimes feel as mourners is what makes us best appreciate the value of celebration. When you inhale the spirit of a city, on both its best and worst days, you find yourself swelling up with joy at events that a younger self might have found banal. The first pitch of a baseball game, the turn of a ceremonial shovel at a groundbreaking, the handing out of an award plaque. Introvert that I am, I even came to love a good parade. In a way, a parade, more than anything, symbolizes this mode of mayorcraft. My parade style is to begin alongside the City of South Bend entry, with as many city employees and interns as we can muster, carrying a banner and passing out candy. But then I inevitably fall behind them as I go along the curb to shake as many hands as possible, and then sprint to catch up to my group before doing the whole thing again. I will meet hundreds of people, but have no actual conversations. The younger me would have dreaded the idea of so many interactions without substance. As I trot by and stick out my hand, I have little to say beyond good morning, or happy St. Patrick's Day, or nice work finding this spot to sit in the shade. Even though it is superficial and brief, there is meaning to each encounter. The purpose of the contact is not to persuade, problem solve, or convey information. That can wait for a mayor's night out, a state of the city speech, a council meeting, or an exchange of letters. This is about being present, on behalf of the city, not as an individual who may have something in particular to offer, but as a mayor whose role is to embody the community. Ceremonies and symbols also serve to express the values of a community, and perhaps this is why I should not have been so surprised by the degree of controversy aroused by the naming of things. The renaming of a post office is sometimes used as a stock example of how Congress wastes its time when it could be doing something more important. But I learned through experience that the renaming of a street could be as significant as any piece of legislation. For as long as I could remember, but in reality only since 2005, our city had a street on the west side named after Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. The drive bearing this name extended less than a mile, and some residents pointed out that not one building actually had MLK Drive as its address. From time to time, someone would come to the open mic portion of a council meeting and argue that the naming ought to be extended to a longer stretch of the road, or applied to a different and more prominent street. It made sense to me. Especially compelling was the idea of making sure it was a street with a bus route. Given the significance of the Montgomery bus boycott, so that a bus could be seen in South Bend with Dr. King's name over its windshield. It turns out that one of the few unilateral unchecked powers that an Indiana mayor has is to rename a street through a city board of public works. So it seemed like I could just uncap my blue pen and take care of the issue. But I also knew to make sure that the choice had some community support, so I worked with our council to set up a volunteer committee of respected local residents to gather feedback and make suggestions. Then came the opposition, surprisingly fierce on the part of some. A remarkable number of reasons were presented to the committee why it couldn't be this street or that street. Some complained about the loss of history if an old name was removed to make room for MLK. Others spoke of the cost to businesses of changing their addresses. Some warned of a loss in land values. Of course, racial tension lurked near the surface of almost all these conversations. But it was always offstage, something you could feel but not point out, shading the discussion through vague allusions to desirability or history. Looking for guidance and precedent, I learned that thousands of pages have been written on the topic, ranging from books with titles as straightforward as Along Martin Luther King Travels on Black America's Main Street, to academic articles as esoteric as Street Naming and the Politics of Belonging, Spatial Injustices in the Toponymic Commemoration of Martin Luther King, Jr. Every idea I floated for such toponymic commemoration met a new angle of resistance. Lincoln Way West drew opposition because it was a historic highway. Extending the existing route along Chapin Street was opposed out of regard for the historic neighborhood and the city father, Horatio Chapin, for whom it was named. The Tribune recounted a 1995 debate on the same topic. Quote, "One lady said, 'Martin Luther King Jr. is dead,' and we said, 'Well, we're pretty sure Mr. Chapin is dead, too,'" end quote. People living in that area hired a lawyer who went so far as to say that it would be illegal for me to rename the street there on the advice of the committee because the city clerk had forgotten to advertise a couple of the committee meetings as required. A lady from that area came to a Mayor's Night Out event and suggested, fire in her eyes, that North Shore Drive, where I lived, should be considered. I was about to tell her that that was fine by me, though I didn't think the community activists would find it prominent enough. But by the time I had the sentence formed in my head, I was looking at her backside as she stomped off, apparently satisfied that she had proven her point with an outrageous suggestion. There turned out to be a natural alternative, St. Joseph Street. There were enough places already named after our area's patron saint of nearly everything, a church, a hospital, a middle school, a high school, the river, and the county, to take a few, that I didn't think he would mind. And with a major downtown streets initiative wrapping up, it would be one of the finest streetscapes in the city. It was prominent, right in the middle of downtown, and had some major addresses on it, including the Century Center and the school corporation. The committee members seemed to like it, though they had made the more modest recommendation of extending the existing road. I announced it, arranged for the street signs to be made, and made it official on Dr. King's birthday in 2017. Achieving this took us 4 years, or over 20, depending how you start the clock. And now, along Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, there has been no cause for regret. The street looks good, and so do the buses bearing Dr. King's name that run along it. Land values are only rising there, and I've heard nothing about any impact on whether the area is desirable. Instead, it is a statement of our city's belief in racial and social justice, and a measure of pride in the diversity of our past and present. It stands among the other ways my administration has found to honor Dr. King, like adding it to the calendar of city holidays, and unveiling a statue of the moment in which he stood arm in arm with Notre Dame's president, Father Ted Hesburgh, in Chicago in 1964, all part of a symbolic texture revealing what is important to our city. Alongside more direct expressions of the lessons of civil rights, like the lectures and exhibits at our Civil Rights Heritage Center, built under my predecessor from the remains of a once-segregated natatorium, it signals to us the value that a city can place on the struggle for justice, and it forces us to acknowledge that the struggle is still underway. On issue after issue, safety, neighborhoods, growth, race relations, and traffic, I learned this lesson. Symbols and ceremonies very much matter, because they establish the tone for all the work we come to do in the public square. And so, one May evening in 2015, some 3 years after wishing that we had a royal family to do things like this so I wouldn't have to, I smiled with sincere pleasure, with a glass of champagne in my hand. From a stage on the concrete island behind the Century Center, amid the rushing waters of the St. Joseph River, I addressed a crowd of thousands and led a toast to the city's 150th birthday. The idea of a major celebration in 2015 had begun during my campaign 4 years earlier. Zoned out from too much call time one day, I was staring blankly at an image of the city seal on some document on my cluttered desk. The seal features a rising sun amid a field of puffy clouds, an American flag, and the word peace. I'd never really paid much attention to it, but now I wondered why the city fathers had chosen this imagery for our seal. Nothing to do with corn or machinery or the river or anything else native to our city. Then my eye fell on the bottom of the seal, where it read, 1865. I went to look up the precise date of the city's incorporation and found that the city was given its present legal form in May of that year, just 6 weeks after Lee's surrender at Appomattox. Now the seal made a lot more sense. The American flag was not some generic symbol of nationalism. It was the flag of a republic whose very existence had just been gravely threatened and freshly vindicated by the grievous and mortal test of the Civil War. The word peace was not a vague blessing or pleasantry then. It was the fond desire of a population traumatized by its opposite. What a hopeful act it would have been to draw up paperwork and formalize the presence of a city in the aftermath of that dreadful conflict, deep in prairie land that was, in those days, still considered the West. And then, instinctively, I did the math. Incorporated in 1865, that meant the city was 146 years old. It followed that the winner of the 2011 campaign would be in office to preside over the 150th anniversary of the city in 2015. Remembering this while on my journey toward recognizing the power of the ceremonial, I came to realize that a major celebration of this date would offer the perfect occasion for something badly needed, a chance to consolidate and celebrate the psychological gains of our present comeback, and to offer a decisive reply to the decades of gloom that had culminated in the stinging mention of our hometown in Newsweek's Dying Cities article. I asked my staff to organize a committee, and we began raising private funds to help mount a sweeping celebration of the city's past, present, and future. Everyone was invited to celebrate in their own way, from a restaurant creating a special dish for the occasion to the library hosting a scan-a-thon for historic family photos. We decided the celebrations should last all year, but the events would hinge on the actual birthday of the city, which happened to fall on Memorial Day weekend. We would close major streets downtown, create a citywide festival with everything from a technology expo and food trucks to a 3-on-3 basketball tournament and zip lines installed over the river. It would all kick off with a party and fireworks show downtown. Of course, if the city hadn't actually been coming back, none of this would have worked. Like an anniversary party for an obviously failing marriage, it would have drawn half-hearted crowds and murmuring behind the scenes. Responses would have been tepid or even sarcastic. Thus, the celebration would function not just to assert, but also to test my claim that the city was on a roll once again. For any of this to work, the contention that South Bend's decline had ended would actually have to be true. But by 2015, there was no denying the real comeback underway. When I had taken office in 2012, the aftereffects of the Great Recession had compounded our half-century-long economic slump and brought us to a miserable unemployment rate of 11.8%, 3 full points above the national average. Now, unemployment was down to 5.6%, a mere half-point from the U.S. rate. We had cleared or fixed most of the 1,000 vacant and abandoned houses at the center of our neighborhood redevelopment strategy. The number of restaurants opening in our once-quiet downtown had doubled. Deals were underway to add 2 major hotels to the city center, and investment was up in our industrial areas. Safety was improving, and at last the national coverage of our city was more likely to be about innovation than post-industrial ruin. Whether by statistics or intuition, you could feel that South Bend was trending in the right direction. And so the banners and fireworks of this birthday party for the city, just the type of civic ceremony I had once dreaded, embodied a kind of propulsive civic energy that was self-fulfilling. Though the effect was beyond quantification, we all sensed that evening an advance in the psyche of our city, which would unlock further investment and growth to come. As I raised the glass and said, "South Bend is back," the roar of the crowd at once reflected, certified, and caused it to be so. Chapter 9. A Plan and Not Quite Enough Time. Only later did I grasp the connection between 200 hours of piano practice and those 1,000 vacant houses in South Bend. Some things like this only become visible with the benefit of hindsight. along with a paper coffee cup with a quote by Leonard Bernstein printed on its side. To achieve great things, two things are needed, a plan and not quite enough time. It was Bernstein who conducted the authoritative recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and he was on my mind as I took a bow, exhilarated and relieved, on the stage of the Morris Performing Arts Center in front of about 2,000 people on a February evening in 2013. I'd been a mayor for 13 months and a concert pianist for 20 minutes. By briefly becoming both, I had found a way to support the arts and to demonstrate how our city can punch above its weight class, all thanks to a chain of events that began with a Soviet defector, a Chinese maestro, and an ambitious music school dean. Indiana University has long boasted a very strong music program, and so does its South Bend campus. At its center is Professor Alexander Taradze, a Georgian pianist who defected from the Soviet Union in 1983 while on tour with the Bolshoi Symphony Orchestra, and somehow wound up in the Hoosier State. The circle of professionals and students who grew around him, known as the Taradze Piano Studio, perform around the world and win prestigious competitions. As if a prerequisite to study with him, his students have magnificently complicated names, like Vakhtang Kodanashvili, one of Taradze's star students who also plays with the South Bend Symphony Orchestra, or Maxim Mogilevsky, who I once saw attack a piano with such vigor during a performance of Mussorgsky that they had to give it a quick retuning at intermission. The presence of so many gifted graduate students meant that South Bend had an abundance of talented and willing piano teachers. They were available at very reasonable rates to parents like my mother, who figured out quickly that I was not destined to be a Division I athlete, and instead developed the hope that I might fund my college education with a music scholarship. She lined up piano teachers starting when I was 5, and continued patiently taking me to lessons every week for years. After my childhood teacher, Kayo Tatebe, moved out of town, Mom began to deliver me every Friday to a basement practice room in IUSB's Northside Hall for lessons from a Singaporean student, Mei Lin Ding, whose name was a rare exception to the polysyllabic norm around the department. When Mei Lin moved on, my mother started taking me half an hour up the road to Berrien Springs in Michigan, where Dr. Sandra Camp lived and practiced her twin passions of music education and cat showmanship, her split-level home containing both a piano studio and a breeding operation. As I became a teenager, the weekly commute ensured a little quality time with one or the other of my parents. We might talk, or not, as we crossed the state line, either in Mom's giant blue Buick LeSabre listening to NPR News, or Dad's two-door Chevy Cavalier listening to what might have been his sole cassette, the Creedence Clearwater Revival masterpiece Cosmos Factory, looping permanently in the tape player for about as long as he owned the car. In a wall-to-wall carpeted room at Dr. Camp's house, full of sheet music and Persian long-haired cats, I labored under her no-nonsense gaze, which in retrospect was itself a little cat-like. She taught me technique and theory, tempo and musicianship, until I became a pretty good pianist, skilled enough to play Rachmaninoff's C-sharp minor prelude in competitions. Good, not great. I rated honorable mentions here and there, but by the time I was a teenager, I was practicing less faithfully and getting more interested in guitar, teaching myself those Creedence songs, then graduating to Jimi Hendrix solos and Dave Matthews acoustic licks. A capable guitarist, I wound up occasionally gigging with a garage band that we called Turkish Delight for some reason I can't remember. While a scholarship wasn't going to happen, music would stay with me as a discipline and a retreat. When I left for college, the Peter 2000, a Stratocaster-type guitar I'd built from a Carvin self-assembly kit, joined me on the trip to Boston. The piano, of course, did not. I stopped playing almost completely until I moved back to South Bend in 2008. Not yet having bought a home, I was renting a carriage house out back of a professor's house farther down the river when my mother, ever the champion of my fleeting music career, overheard a stranger on a bus in Chicago lamenting that he couldn't get rid of his old piano. Having once heard me say something about wanting a keyboard, she sidled up to him and asked if he was selling a piano. "No, I'm trying to give it away. No one wants it. I'm about ready to put it in a Glad bag and drop it out the window," he told her. What did my mother say to him next? Who knows? But soon after that, I found myself standing among knickknacks in this gentleman's carpeted apartment in Chicago, looking at a rather neglected antique grand piano. The pianist in the household had been his wife. She had passed away years ago. The instrument was not in great shape. It hadn't been tuned for years. Some keys were broken and others didn't move at all. But it looked like something that could be repaired. So I called Steve Merriman, a neighbor of my parents who seems to embody one of South Bend's defining characteristics, a knack for salvage and reuse. Some years ago, Steve and his wife Mary launched a piano tuning business, which developed into piano reconditioning and more. Over time, the business escalated into a kind of mission. Whenever Steve hears of a piano on its way to the landfill, someone passing away, a church moving, a school upgrading its instruments, he intervenes and commences a rescue. He recently moved his operations into a disused dry cleaning facility with all the space he needed both to store and fix them. But back then, he was constantly negotiating with someone to get more space to park the pianos he had caught and saved, unwanted and unplayable. At his pleading, someone's garage or storeroom would become a foster home for his wayward instruments until he could get them repaired. Like a devoted volunteer at an animal rescue shelter, he's always on the lookout for potential owners, anyone who will fund him to fix an instrument. He's not really looking to sell or flip the pianos, just seeking someone to cover the cost of his time to restore them. In fact, he's not even a pianist. He's a jazz drummer, but he has a compelling vision that a good instrument belongs in every home. As he once told me in his gravelly voice, his eyes at once smiling and piercing, "I just believe that every house ought to have a furnace, it ought to have a toilet, and it ought to have a piano." So, standing in the living room of a bemused elderly gentleman in Chicago, preparing to leave his wife's possessions behind and go to a second retirement somewhere in Mexico, we called Steve back in South Bend, describing the piano to him and asking if he thought he could fix it. A couple weeks later, the living room of my modest quarters had been converted into a sort of piano workshop. The black hulk of an instrument now dominated the room, surrounded by little pieces of wood, scraps of felt, and a mysterious arsenal of tools as Steve took the piano apart and put it back together. And soon after that, for about as much money as I had saved to spend on a good keyboard, I was the proud new owner of a working 1920s Conover Grand. I noodled on it every now and then, but didn't play that much, until one day in 2012, when I heard from Dr. Marvin Curtis, Dean of the School of the Arts at IU South Bend. He was looking for me to do something with the symphony orchestra, some gimmick to show my support for the arts and help drive up ticket sales. Occasionally, for example, they arranged for a community leader to guest conduct a piece. Would I be up for something like that? Sure, I said. Anything to support the symphony. Then I thought, aloud, what if I actually played something? Could I perform a serious piece of music with the South Bend Symphony Orchestra? Marvin embraced the idea so readily that I now think he hatched the idea before I did. Maybe he had heard from someone around town that I used to play. He promptly sent me to meet the orchestra's maestro, Tsung Ye, at his house for what began as a social cup of coffee, but ended up more like an audition. The maestro had presided over our South Bend Symphony Orchestra for more than 20 years. I could remember school trips to see him conduct educational concerts, and was known for squaring a genial demeanor with an exacting command of a symphony several notches above what you might expect for a mid-sized city in Indiana. I hadn't played consistently in more than a decade, and never with an orchestra. But after hearing me play some things I could still remember, the maestro concluded I might be up to it. What better way to send a message that the arts were vital to the city than for the mayor to perform with the local orchestra? I thought of the blue-jacketed solo arrangement of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, which came into my underused sheet music collection when my grandmother, herself a piano teacher, had passed away. Even when she was still living, I used to find it on her bookshelf and try to tap out Gershwin's familiar passages. My hands not yet big enough, I tried to reach the octaves of its soaring final theme, known to a generation of commercial watchers and frequent flyers as the official music of United Airlines. Considered by many to be Gershwin's masterpiece, Rhapsody is a rollicking ecstasy of jazzy piano and symphonic interplay. To me, it is the most American piece of orchestral music ever written. I'd always loved it, but never actually learned it properly, nor even reached the skill level needed to play it. But Marvin had a plan. "We just have to get some Russian in you." And by Russian, in this case, he meant Georgian. He arranged a course of lessons with Edisher Savitsky, one of Taraza's star graduate students. A genial man with a cloud of wavy dark hair, Edisher would spend an hour with me every week, patiently coaching me into becoming a concert pianist, with not quite enough time. We had 6 months. I practiced every day, usually early in the morning, on my old grand piano, which probably hadn't been played 2 days in a row since Ronald Reagan was in office. On this ambitious timeline, daily practice was a must. A famous pianist, the internet can't agree which one, once said, "If I miss 1 day of practice, I notice it. If I miss 2 days, the critics notice it. If I miss 3 days, the audience notices it." The quotation became my mantra. If I was traveling, I found some way to get access to a piano, at the home of an acquaintance, perhaps, or an unsecured hotel ballroom where the night maintenance staff could be relied on to look the other way. Once, around 5:30 in the morning, I found myself in O'Hare Airport on my way to Miami to see Notre Dame play for the BCS title, aware that I might not see a piano for 3 days. I found one by gate C-16, alongside a deserted bar, a discreet rope around it, no bench. The concourse was almost empty. I gingerly moved the rope and wheeled up my rollerboard bag to sit on, and I began to play. Pretty soon I had a couple listeners, then a small audience, and at the end there was applause, and, awkwardly, a couple of dollar tips. If I was running with Tim and Joe in the morning, then I'd fight exhaustion and practice before bed. Once, after a near all-nighter coming home from the Democratic Convention in Charlotte in time to host Mitch Daniels, our Republican governor, for a lunch with business leaders, I hurried home for a lesson in between the airport and the restaurant. Standing, as Edisher demonstrated a passage for me, I felt my knees go out from under me and grabbed the side of the piano. He looked over, alarmed, and asked if I was all right. I had fallen asleep, standing up. As I got to know Edisher, I learned more of his story. He had come from the Republic of Georgia at Taraz's invitation, with no money and no English. He was already emerging as a world-class pianist. He once won a grand piano at an international competition, but had to start from zero financially. While enrolled at IUSB, he got a job making submarine sandwiches at a blimpy in a strip mall on South Bend Avenue. He described to me once covering a sandwich in garlic powder after misunderstanding a customer's emphatic and repeated demands to have no garlic on his sandwich. He's since become a professor, a fitting outcome for a classically American story of opportunity. But when I think about his journey, I can't get past the thought that it was a crime to allow such talented fingers so near to a meat slicer. Each week, for 1 hour, he would sit in my living room and hone my technique. I'd play a passage for him, and he would lean back, thoughtfully, bring his hands together and say, "Okay, lots of beautiful things, now." And here he'd begin deconstructing my performance and putting it back together. He would say things that sounded strange at first, like, "Don't play the notes, just play the music." Explaining how to make one passage twinkle, he described the first time he saw an American Disney cartoon and asked me to evoke its characters. It seemed cryptic at first, but began to make sense over time. After a couple of months, I was dreaming Rhapsody in Blue. I could close my eyes, start at any point, and play the rest of the piece in my mind. After 2 rehearsals with the orchestra, which were my first and second times ever playing piano with an orchestra, it was time for the performance. The whole program was Gershwin, with 2 talented vocalists teed up to do Porgy and Bess for the second half. My part would be before intermission. The date was February 16th, the show called A Valentine from Gershwin. I did my best to stay calm in the dressing room as the maestro warmed up the orchestra and the audience with Strike Up the Band. Then I hovered off stage as they turned to An American in Paris. Finally, it was time. Wearing a suit instead of a tux, a concession to the reality that at the end of the day I was a mayor, not a professional pianist, I stepped out onto the blonde wood of the stage at the Morris Performing Arts Center, a space that started as a grand vaudeville house in the 1920s and became a movie theater before the city took it over and renovated it. Through the glare of the spotlights, I could just barely make out a sea of over 2,000 faces. It was more than I'd ever seen for a symphony performance. I wondered if they were there because they loved Gershwin or to cheer me on. Some part of me sensed that many had in fact come to see if I would succeed or not. Beyond the unlikeliness of the spectacle, it was above all the possibility of failure that created the suspense. I exhaled, took a bow, and walked toward the piano. I had decided at the last minute not to bring sheet music. It was just me and the instrument, the orchestra to one side and the audience to the other. I had given speeches to crowds this size with no discomfort, but this was terrifying. Lose your place in a speech, you can take a breath and resume. Lose the orchestra in a fast-moving passage, and you might never find your place again. But I had practiced this thing into the deepest furrows of my brain. I was ready. I settled onto the bench, breathed again, looked at the maestro, and gave a little nod. The clarinet began with that famous trill, turning into a scale.